Okay, the end of the third parak. We're about six lines from the bottom. Remember, agav to this discussion about which parts of the Targum would be read out loud, taught out loud, and which would be censored is not the correct word, but
not translated.
Yeah, suppressed.
Yeah.
So the Gemara starts mentioning all types of all types of things that aren't mentioned out loud, and then it gets into the topic of kriyuchtiv, words that are written one way. This is part of the Masora, that there are words that are written one way and they are read another. Now, why that is, it seems to be for a variety of reasons. If you're interested in the classification of the different categories of kriyuchtiv. I believe there are five of them, but I'm quoting that from memory because I haven't looked at what I'm about to mention in about, 30 years. There's an excellent article in the Encyclopedia Talmudit.
Talmudit?
Yes, but where in the Encyclopedia? It's not under Kri.
Definitely not Kri.
Maybe it's under
Khtiv. I don't think Khtiv was out 30 years ago.
It's in the Encyclopedia Talmudit. There's an article about Kri Khtiv. But it's
maybe like Altica. Like
maybe, yeah. So I only know this because 30 years ago I wrote a paper in college on Kriyuchtiv, which was, you know, largely cribbed from this article.
You know what the entry is going to be for Tisha B'Av and Encyclopedia Talmudic? The day the Jews used to fast.
But by the time they get to it, yeah.
That's a joke I heard.
25 years ago. Yeah, what are they up to? Which?
Maybe Ramen, man.
Now the Gemara says, you see the first word on the line is Omar. Mm-hmm. Omar of Nachman. Kol etzinuta asira. Bar miletzinuta da avodas kochavim. So all types of jocularity, joking around, fooling around. I mean, I said this was like the joke. In other words, I told you that I think that there's like a sense of humor here, particularly in Masechet Megillah. Because after a number of lines, being a little jocular, Rav Nachman comes along and says, you know, it's also to joke around. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean you can't have a sense of humor.
Well, the difference between mitzaruta and bedichuta.
Yeah, so a bedicha, humor, a potchin b'mila bedichuta, right, that every shiur should begin with a little bit of... levity, little lightheartedness, but litzonos is clowning around, horsing around, might even connote some kind of lewdness. So that is certainly osur. Bar melitzonos et avodas kochavim. Unless the butt of the joke is avodah zara. Dichtiv. So here's a point. What's the proof? What's the proof of somebody who jokes around about Avodah Zarah? No less than Yeshaya Navi. Kara Bal Kores Nevo. These are different Elilim. So one of them crouches down and the other is bent over. Meaning they're depicted in states of defecating. V'chtiv, karsu, karu, yachdav, they hunched over, they bowed down, lo yachlu, malet masa, and they couldn't unburden themselves. Meaning, your avodah zara. In other words, it's
constipated.
Yeah. In other words, it's like this idea that in other words, you think your avodah zara, your the statue that you worship. It has like power. It's like it can do things, right? I can't do anything except go to the John, right? And even that it can't do. Right? Now, you think that your pestle is alive. It's only alive for the purposes of a bowel movement, and it should be blocked up. I'm sure there's a good Yiddish, frothy Yiddish curse here, right? It should be blocked up like something. Like
that. What was that? Not even one form.
Traffic,
is that not a form?
The
traffic
as well.
By the statue.
No, I don't think so. Yecholia? Oh, welcome back. So we learn from here. So here's this pasuk from Hosea. La'agalot beit avon yaguru shochen shomron ki avel alav amo uchmarav alu yagilu alav yagilu al kvodo ki galam imenu. That the people from the Shomron that worship this Avodah Zarah, so they would mourn over the Avodah Zarah if the, like I said, the Avodah Zarah got destroyed, and the priests would be happy about the Avodah Zarah. I mean, they had like this emotional attachment to these things. And if the Avodah Zarah would be destroyed, they would mourn over the kavod shegala mimena. In other words, that the welcome back and Rafua Shleima. Are we still in the Rafua Shleima? Farman was there?
Not 100% yet.
Okay.
Got back on the bike, so that's good.
So, in other words, if the Avodah Zarah was somehow desecrated, so its kavod, its honor, was stripped away from it. So the Gemara says, Al tikre kvodo, ela kvedo. Kvedo is... well, the thing you carry around, the weight that you carry around. But in this case, what you carry around in your intestines, right? So again, this kind of scatological humor directed at the Avodah Zarah.
Omar Rav Huna bar Manoach, Mishmed Rav Acha, Barei de Rav Ika, Sharei Le Levar Yisrael, Lememar Lo Oved Kochovim, Shakle Lavodas Kochovim, Vancheya Beshin Taf.
In other words, generally speaking, Frumer Yidden are careful to speak properly, not to have nivel peh, not to talk foul, not to... what is that? What's his name? The President of the United States. Oh, locker room banter, right? So locker room banter is the... It's the makshir. Like, and as you could say... That's what things have come to. You can say anything no matter how foul and vulgar it is, as long as you put it between the air quotes of locker room banter. So Frumer Yidden don't even use locker room banter. Right? So you can say, so generally, you know, but about Avodah Zarah, you can use this, what is this locker room banter? To cause them to shin. It's like when you were a kid, you weren't allowed to curse. Like if you cursed, your mother would wash your mouth out with soap. So you would say you had... Lashon Sagi Nohar for curse words, right? You'd say like H-E double toothpicks, because if you spelled it out, it wasn't like really like saying it. So here's a shin. So you say you take your Avodah Zarah and stick it up your shin tuff. Maze shin tuff. Well, you understand what the shin tuff is if I tell you to stick the Avodah Zarah.
What
the piyat habat, right? So shin tuff. Rashi says, Lashon v'chasufe shet ervat Mitzrayim. Right? Stick it up. Basically, stick it where the sun don't shine.
Omer of Ashi, Haiman desanai shom'ena.
But somebody who's... somebody whose reputation has been tarnished. Right? That the shmu'ot about him... have been tarnished.
Rashi says sheyotzot alav shmuot ra'ot v'snuot shehu no'ef.
Particularly somebody who's been accused of licentiousness, fooling around with ladies he shouldn't be with.
Right? Sharei l'labzuye begimel v'shin.
So you can say about this guy that he's a gimel shin. What's gimel shin? So it's not perfectly clear. Rashi says it's giufa shaita, a foolish zona, a foolish prostitute, right? Or maybe it's goya shifcha, that he's the son of a shiksa slave. right? But whatever it is, it's a kind of nasty thing to say. But we don't say it. We say it. You know, Bereshit Tevot kaze. Because if you say Bereshit Tevot, like, you know, like for example, in America now, the N word.
You can say like
S O B. Or S O B, right? In other words, the N word. The N word. The N word has become so charged that anybody that should utter it.
But only someone with an N can say it.
Seder, in certain contexts, that's always true for every racial group, right? That's true for every racial group. But that you have certain, you know, in-house, you have certain, because it doesn't carry the same force that if somebody from the outside calls you. So the N-word is so, like, charged that even if somebody says it, somebody told me they were...
What can we say, the shin word?
Yeah. Right, so even the shin word, right? Somebody would use the shin, somebody in the Knesset would use the shin word.
Yeah.
They'd be probably with a rating. No, they'd be the whole shumu shamayim, the whole word would fall down on them. And in America, my God, a politician would use the N word, it'd be the end. So,
by the way, they all know the shin word.
So,
one piece of Yiddish,
Rabbi Bravender once told me that when he was a kid, he'd be on the trolley with his father. His father would call them bluyas. In Yiddish for blues.
Yeah, instead of
shakes. So why blues? It's because they know what that other word, right? To use the shin word, they all know what that means. So you have to choose it. Some word.
I used to get Gaylor.
Gaylor?
Yellow.
Oh, yeah, right. So, but the same idea that you don't use the word, but you use some Rashi Tevot that allude to the word, which kind of neutralizes it of its there in the cases that I gave of his offense here of its vulgarity, because it's not proper. Asla adam hotzi davar meguna mitoch piv, says the Gemara. A person can't utter a foul kind of word. Hi, man, the shopir shomena, but somebody who has a good reputation, share le shavchue, it's permitted to praise him. Uman de shavchue yanuchu lo brachot arosho, and if the person who praises somebody whose reputation is good, so the brachot come back and land on his own head. Which ties up nicely with all those sugyot about Birkot Kohanim that we saw earlier in the pack. What's the half? Why does the Gemara need to teach you that you can
just to end on a good note?
So yeah, want to end on a nice note. You don't want to end on this Gimel Shin or the Shin Tav, this whatever. But Enochinami, it's still a halacha. What's the halacha? Speaking of people whose reputations have been tarnished. Baby's in trouble.
So, again?
No, the police are there. They're issuing the. Yeah, they're issuing their. Well, not the Ketav Yishuv, they're Hamlatzot.
Somewhere?
In 3 seconds, we're going to make a seam on the Perek. You're just in time.
Perfect.
So, in other words, Enochinami, it's true you want to end on a positive note, but nevertheless, the comment itself still has to have some meaning. What's the Havamina that you wouldn't be able to say something positive?
Make them arrogant.
Make the hearer, the person, okay.
There's something not praising too much in the presence, right? There's some.
Yeah, so there is this general idea of not overly praising somebody in their presence, because it's... But even not in their presence because of Lashon Hara. There's this idea that, in other words, if we go on and on and on about how great Steve is, so somebody might feel compelled to offer a counterpoint.
I'll take care of him later.
Step outside.
Steve signed you Darvish for 6 years.
Hadran Allah HaKoreh Samigila Omed V'hadra Chalan Shkoyach. Okay.
Really walked in just in time.
Yes. Have a drink.
Affordable.
The fourth parak is really the third parak. There's an interesting phenomena that exists, I think, at least two places in Shas. In the Mishnah, in Sanhedrin, and here, the Mishnah, if you look in the Mishnah, if you take a Mishnah off the shelf, what we call the fourth parak is the third parak and vice versa. If you look in the Yerushalmi, a printing of the Yerushalmi, this fourth parak is the third parak and vice versa. In the Bavli, for some reason, the printer switches them.
But you had said previously, but you said in the past that the Mishnayot that we have now are not any sort of, like, just like the printer's choice, how the Mishnayot were
the order of the Mishnayot, right, within the Seder.
No, like, you know, the breaking up of the Dupim and all that, so it's
no, right, no, in other words, the ordering of the Starim, the ordering of the Mishnayot into the Starim is with the ordering of the Mishnayot within the Starim, which goes back to, I mean, there are a few differences here and there, particularly in the printing of the Bavli as we have it, because sometimes, like with the smaller Masechtot that are jumped, you know, in other words, there was some limit in the printing technology of how big a book could be or how practical it could be. As if you look at a standard printing of the Shas, like the Talmud Shas, every volume is more or less the same size. And this is for marketing reasons, and this is for all types of things. When we did that, we just finished the Agnon series, it's 15 books. The publisher very much wanted that each volume should be more or less the same size within 50 pages of the other, because it's just easier to market. Each volume then is the same price. And I couldn't do it. There was just no way to arrange the story. So some books are I think the biggest book is like 600 pages, and some books are 250 pages. And when they're on the shelf, it doesn't look as nice as if they were all of identical size. So in order to get each volume more or less the same size, so sometimes they had to, within a Seder, they had to like move Masechet Horiot from what should have been in this volume, and instead we moved it to there. But the ordering of the Masechtot within each Seder is more or less by size, from largest to smallest. Nevertheless, the Rambam in his Hakdama LePerush HaMishnayot and other Parshanim also give these like drashot for, like, you know, why this comes first and it's followed by that one and it's followed, like, so kind of like a thematic drasha to connect the progression of ideas, but that's at best a drasha. Within each parak, the division of the Mishnayot into Mishnah Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, that's a much later convention, which is not universal, by the way. You know, like if you look in Pirkei Avos, I don't know why this is, but the Pirkei Avos, as it appears in the Siddur, some of the Prakim, the Mishnayot are divided one way. So like, I'm making these numbers up off the top of my head, but if you look, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Yud Dalid, in the way it's printed in the Siddur, is not going to be the same way it's printed in a set of the Mishnah. I don't know why that is. But the division into the individual Mishnayot is somewhat... is a much later convention, and that's just done for handy reference purposes. Then the way that the Mishnayot are divvied up within each perek doesn't even follow that, because sometimes you'll have like what are printed as two different Mishnayot will appear together in the Gemara, and sometimes, as we saw, I think when we learned Sanhedrin a couple of years ago, in the beginning of Sanhedrin, the printer puts all of the Mishnayot and the Perek up front. There are a couple of places in Shas where you have this. Instead of the way we have it, we have a little Mishnah, a little Gemara, a little Mishnah, a little Gemara. The whole Perek of Mishnayot is up front, and then you have all of the Gemara on that Mishnah for reasons that are unknown to me, although I'm sure people have discussed this. So the flipping of the Prakim here is... I have no way to explain it besides letting you know that it exists. Okay, so here's the Mishnah. The parak's called B'nei Ha'ir, the townsman. B'nei Ha'ir shemachru rechova shel ir, lokchin b'damav beit ha'kneset. The rechova shel ir was the town square. You know, think of like old European-style towns, although of course the Mishnah was not talking about Europe, but from movies we might be able to conjure that up a little more. There was a central... If you've been to Prague... Right? You've been to in the Italian city, right? In other words, there was one town, central town square. I think even in the old city, if you can imagine the old city in the when it was really old. That's exactly what I'm referring to. The Rechava there by the Churva, between the Churva, right? So it was a central town square where people would gather. When would they gather Rechava Shilir? Oh. If it was just for market days, that would not be significant for our conversation. We have to talk about something having to do with Kedusha. The Mishnah is talking about the halacha of ma'alin b'kodesh v'lo maridin. That you can only elevate, you can't desecrate holy matters. So if the townsmen sell this town square, that money, the Kedusha of the town square, is transferred to the money. And the money, we have this idea, what's the most immediate example of this idea that Kedusha transfers to money? Masrot, or it's true, yeah, Masrot, we have this idea that that it can be done, but what's an example where it happens?
First fruits.
What?
First fruits.
No. You use money.
You redeem it. The money doesn't get the Kedusha. Yeah, but...
First fruit, you convert to money, take it to Shlain.
Yes, you can do that. But you don't have to. You can also take the fruit. Right? Shmita. Perot Kedushat Shvit. If you deal in Perot Kedushat Shvit, if you violate the terms of how Kedushat Shvi'et Perot can be marketed, so the money becomes Kadosh. The Kedusha transfers to the money, which is a serious problem, because presumably a certain percentage of our currency floating around the country is we don't know it. You can't tell. There's no way to identify. That would be, you know, all these new things they put in the new currency. All these anti-theft and blinds, and if they would have put in some kind of marker that showed that this money had... But yes, but all these other examples are also cases where the money accepts the Kedusha. Pidyon by Sasheni, and etc., etc. So if they... Yeah, except we still pasuk in that. In other words, the coins, what does it mean they had an intrinsic value? They were made out of metal.
Made out of silver, gold.
Right, and we ascribe value to these otherwise valueless metals. They're precious because we imagine them to be precious. It's the fiction that runs the economy. And why does a piece of paper with Rachel HaMishoeret on it have value? For the same reason.
No, but I mean, those coins were worth their weight in that. But even that it was a gold coin, it had a certain weight, and it was worth its weight in gold.
Even gold, right? Has a...
I understand.
And if tomorrow everybody would decide that the gold has no value, or if we were to decide underneath, we would discover underneath everybody's house.
Idea was
no, if everybody would discover underneath their pillow there were 10 pounds of gold, the value would
okay,
would
but
change.
They didn't, and that's why gold had the value, because it was right, a little harder to come by.
But well, so are paper. So is paper money with a picture of.
Although, if there's any biblical law based on this, that becomes a problem, because coins didn't come around until the Persian Greek period. So any halachot they're dealing with, you know, if we talk about machzik the shekel, we often think of those coins. It's actually just weight of.
But right. Even once you have coinage, halacha recognizes the.
Same, but you can say that if it was. You know, you can imagine a matzav where they were talking about the certain weight of gold that had to be, you know, for use. Right. That actually might be like what the spirit
says. But for our purposes, our paper money, which is not backed by its weight in gold, our currency is not on the gold standard. Our money has the halacha of money, whether it's a coin or whether it's paper, it's whatever it is. This chumrah that people have to do the machatzit shekel with an actual machatzit shekel is a nice minug, right? But it's not, you know, or even you know, the people when you do a pidyon haben. Did you have to make a pidyon haben?
My wife is about coin.
Oh, your wife's about coin. That's right. So we had to do a pidyon haben, rather at the last minute, as I've told you many times. So I went and I got these sla'im, you know, these actual slugs of silver. But not everybody does that, and you use money, paper money, right? Whatever. Anyway, b'nei ha'ir shemachu rechova shel ir lochin be'damav beit knesset. The money that you sold the rechova shel ir, you could take that and you can upgrade and buy a synagogue or buy a building to be used as a synagogue.
Why does the rechova shel ir have kedusha?
Why does the rechova shel ir have kedusha? Excellent question. So Rashi says yesh bo kedusha k'dimefarish b'gemara ho'ilo mitpalin bo b'ta'aniot u'b'ma'amadot. The Rechava Shel Ir was used not just for market, which it was, but for prayer. Sometimes prayers were held in the Rechava Shel Ir, just like we did whenever it was a couple weeks ago when they had on, when was that? On Sar B'Tevet. The Sar B'Tevet, they, and it was underneath that, that was the slogan that they put on those flyers, right? Motzin et ha-teva el Rechava Shel Ir. So our Rechava Shel Ir is Parka Asur, right? Why is that and not some other? Because that's the place where, on the rare occasions that the whole town has to gather, on Yom Ha'atzmaut, on Yom Yushalayim, on some other event, we gather in the Parka Asur, and they motzin et ha-teva, they take out the aron to the Parka Asur, to the Rechava Shel Ir, and they daven there. So it turns out this is a machlokas. It's a machlokus whether or not the Rechava Shel Ir actually has kedusha. Rashi says the Rechava Shel Ir has kedusha because it's used for prayer. Yeah,
so that was my.
But
my other thought.
But in fact, towns sell off property all the time. A kablan comes in and wants to put up buildings in Park Asur.
The Moitza would totally do it.
The Moitza
in the Mishnah.
Apparently.
The property was owned by somebody?
The Moitza?
King.
Either it was owned by, look, in medieval Europe, or even in early modern Europe. Right? The town was owned by
200 apartments on top.
In Poland. In Poland, in Galicia, the Polish nobility. Long after this went out of fashion in England, the Polish nobility gave land holdings to noblemen, and the noblemen kept the order, and they did that by creating the system where the local population were oppressed, where there was some middleman, sometimes Jews, that managed the affairs in town. In Galicia, in what's today Ukraine, right? The people that lived there were these Ukrainian peasants. They were controlled by the Polish crown. Up until 1792, they were controlled by the Polish crown. Right? And there'd be a local lord or noble or baron or whatever title of honor was used in Poland, who owned the town. For all intents and purposes, he owned the town. And in the times when there were serfs, he owned the serfs as well. Right? In other words, the serfs weren't owned by, it wasn't like American chattel slave where anybody would go and buy a slave. The serfs were owned by the nobility as a whole. And they would use the Jews as middlemen. The Jews were the managers of all the estates. The Jews often had the chakira, the license to run the taverns, because the Jews could be trusted to run the taverns because they themselves were not drunkards. And if we let the Ukrainians run it, they would drink up all the profits. Right? And the noblemen who owned the grain fields and who use their grain to turn into liquid currency, right? Meaning liquor. Right? So the Jews admitted, this is why the Ukrainians did not very much like the Jews, because they were the middlemen between the Polish nobility and their own miserable little oppressed life.
Happened not just there. I mean, that was like a pattern throughout most of Jewish history.
Yes.
Besides, like,
yes.
With Yosef.
Right. Correct. But in other words, when you ask, did people really own? Yeah. So the nobleman in Buchach, whose name was Potocki, Pataki, right? You know,
yeah,
Pataki, so governor of
So it was like Greece.
No. It's Slovenian. He's Ukrainian. So Pataki was the governor of New York, is part of this shalshelet of the Potocki family, and they own vast, right, swaths of what today is Western Ukraine, which then was Eastern Galicia, and they owned the town. And if they wanted to, they could have sold the Rechava Shel Yir and Menelit. Number two, Beit Knesset. If you sell, you have to read between the lines of the Mishnah. Beit Knesset lochin b'teva. If you sell a synagogue, you have to use the money to buy an Aron Kodesh. An Aron Kodesh is more kadosh than a whole Beit Knesset.
It costs as much as a Beit Knesset.
Says the man who donated the Aron Kodesh.
But just think logically. A building doesn't cost as much as an
Aron.
Yeah, no, but it doesn't matter. And as it could be, you sell the building for X. And an Aron costs one-tenth of X. You have to buy 10 Aronot.
But there were all these cases in the 60s, 70s of Jews moving out of the urban areas and selling
more to
the country. And they like sell it for like $1. That was luckily okay. I mean, you know, even if you, as long as you sell for eight, you maybe you sell $1 to buying a table.
I don't know that they were selling it for $1.
There were a lot of cases. I think in Boston, there were cases like this where they fled the area. They were like, okay, we're just.
Yeah, so if you go over to Yeshivat Har Etzion, what does it say on the front door of Yeshivat Har Etzion? Congregation Sons of Israel, Newark, New Jersey. Newark being an area that once had, when my mother grew up there, had, 150 shuls. Today it has zero shuls. In the 60s, they all the Jews, all the Yidden ran away and moved to the suburbs.
The ends moved in.
Every town
they had
that. Well, the ends moved in.
Yeah. So let's keep it clean, fellas. So what did they do? They took the money and they transferred it to build a yeshiva. Right? Teva lochin. So, in other words, if you sell a Beit Knesset, you have to buy an Aron, a Teva, an Aron. Teva lochin mitpachot. What are mitpachot? Not what your wife wears on her head.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so apparently the Sifrei Torah, well, we have these, the mantle, the cover of the Sifrei Torah, this kind of custom fitted thing, is a more modern invention. In the days of old, they would have a. You know, like a, what do you call that? Not a gartle. What? A wimple.
A wimple.
Right? And wrap up, you know, almost like mummy-like. You know, not like the gartle. When you do Hagban Glila, you have that little belt that you put around the thing. So not like that. But you would wrap up like mummy-like the safer to keep it safe.
You ever been in the shul in Rome? It's always like you need four people to undress the Sefer Torah before they read it.
Uh-huh. Mitpachat yichu svarim. If you sell the mitpachat, you can buy svarim. What are svarim? So Rashi says nevim uchtuvim. You can buy a Megillat Esther. You can buy a Sefer Yeshayahu. Right? That's what Rashi says. The Meiri says svarim means sifrei kodesh. Right now, in the times of the Meiri, they didn't have Sifrei Kodesh, didn't look like this. But what would you have if you wanted to buy, you know, for a bar mitzvah present? You wanted to buy Mishnayot. What would you do? Yeah. In other words, they had just. It looked like a Megillah, right? And it was the text of the
Pshat, the Mishnah. Is that they were talking about the Vim Tunin, because they weren't talking about the Mishnah since it was in the Mishnah.
No, but it could have been referring to any other types of.
Our own was much smaller.
Yes, it's true. But the Meiri says this nevertheless. But the question is obvious. The Rambam says svarim would mean what we call a chumash. In other words, they had chumashim, not chumashim like chumashim, but they'd have a scroll with Sefer Bereshit in it. Not for ritual reading purposes, but for
following along from your seat.
Yeah, well, you
like we have our own Megillah. So
no, but your Megillah is a kosher Megillah. You could read from it.
Yeah.
What would be the purpose of having a Sefer Shmot written either on cloth or on some other?
They didn't have books.
They didn't have books. That was a book. That was your kid came home from school. He had to do homework.
Just
like we say, go get a chumash from the shelf. That's what it is. It was much cheaper to do that because A, it was only one and not all five. B, it wouldn't have to be written with all the exact drishot of a proper Sefer Torah. It was probably still rather expensive because it had to be handwritten, but it wasn't the same as writing a one-fifth of a proper kosher Sefer Torah. So that's what the Rambam says. Aval im machru Torah. Oh, svarim lochin Torah. And if you sell svarim, you can use that money only to buy a Sefer Torah. So in the hierarchy of Kedusha, from lowest to the highest, we go Rechava Shel Ir, Beit Knesset, Teva, meaning Aron Kodesh, Mitpachot, the wrappings of a Sefer Torah, Svarim, which let's say means Nevi'im Uchtuvim, Sefer Torah.
I'm sorry, but money-wise, it doesn't make sense.
It has nothing to do with money. It has to do with Kedusha. Okay. What's more expensive? What's more expensive? To write a Sefer Torah or to build a whole synagogue?
To build a whole synagogue.
Which has more Kedusha?
Sefer Torah. No, I understand what you're saying. Okay, I understand that, but I'm saying...
Practically speaking, I just sold a bunch of chumashim.
You have to spend it on anything higher on the menu.
No, I understand.
I just sold a bunch of chumashim. I don't have the money now to go build a Sefer Torah. So what am I supposed to do? Just keep the money in a safe way?
You can combine
it with other money.
Put it in your Sefer Torah fund.
You can donate it to somebody who's doing a Achnasat Sefer Torah. But you can't use it to buy wild turkey. As holy as wild turkey, maybe.
It's very holy. It's very good.
Thanksgiving.
Now, flip. Oh, so Rechava Shel Ir, Rashi says Rechava Shel Ir is Kedusha, because sometimes you daven there. The Rambam disagrees. When the Rambam codifies this Mishnah, he skips the whole Inyan of Rechava Shel Ir and says Rechava Shel Ir does not have Kedusha. Because it's just used extemporaneously. But it doesn't take on proper Kedusha. The truth is that even our synagogues don't always have proper Kedusha. When we moved in here, we'll get to this, it's a major topic in the Perek. What's a Beit Knesset? Is it obvious what a Beit Knesset is? Is a caravan a Beit Knesset? Just because you daven there?
Could be.
Could be. I hope not, because we knocked it down. So it's not clear what exactly a Beit Knesset is. And when we moved in here, you know, there are dinim about a Beit Knesset and what you can do in a Beit Knesset and what you can't do in a Beit Knesset.
That's like how the Rav Catholic is.
Yeah. So when we moved in here, the first Shabbat, I said to Berniker, said, make an announcement. That what we call the shul is really a Rav Tachliti. Most of the time we daven there, but we do all types of other things there. Right? I was here at Bar Mitzvah, somebody was doing a chocolate fountain. That's not the kind of thing you normally do in a synagogue, where, by the way, you're not allowed to eat. A Beis Medrash, which actually ironically has a higher Kedusha, this is another topic that's going to come up in the parak. A Beis Medrash has a higher Kedusha than a Beit Knesset, but a Beis Medrash, we're lenient, we allow you to eat, Baruch Hashem, to eat and drink in a Beit Knesset because people kind of, in a Beit Midrash, I mean, because you kind of live in the Beis Medrash and it's not reasonable not to eat and drink there.
Could it be that the Mishnah wrote this not as a way of also keeping the Moitzot in check? Because otherwise, it would sell off all the public squares and put up housing and shopping malls and whatever, and then there'd be no public squares. There'd be no places for Beit Knesset. There'd be no places to grow with Tushanim, this is a way of keeping
that's
them.
That's how we need nowadays, my friend.
Maybe. I don't know.
You know, because if you tell me, okay, you have a public square, but you can only sell it and use it for Beit Knesset. Well, we already have three Beit Knesset, so we don't need it, so we'll keep it.
I mean, look, the truth is that we have, in modern urban planning, both here and elsewhere, we do have these zoning rules.
Yeah.
This plot is zoned for this. It's zoned for a park. You can't do anything else there.
Until the Taba changes.
Right.
I'm just saying, no, but the point is
that...
Muncie?
Yeah. But the point is that, in other words, to change it is meant to be a hurdle that's hard to... a hoop that's hard to jump through so that it shouldn't be changed just randomly. Okay, so it's this...
Which is why that front thing is still zoned as commercial.
Right. Now the Mishnah goes in the opposite direction. Aval in machru Torah, if you sell a Sefer Torah, lo yikhu svarim. Svarim lo yikhu mitpachot. Mitpachot lo yikhu teva. Teva lo yikhu Beit Knesset. Beit Knesset lo yikhu et harachov v'chein b'motrehen. What's motrehen?
Whatever was left over.
So this is your thing. You sell the whole synagogue. So the synagogue, the building, you sold it for $1 million. And you went and you bought a very nice Sefer Torah for $250,000. That doesn't now free up the remainder, the balance, the other 750 grand, right? In other words, all of that money, down to the last penny, has the Kedusha of a Sefer... No.
So if I sell a Sefer Torah, what do I do with the money?
The rest of the money? You buy another Sefer Torah.
A better one.
So I can only sell a Sefer Torah to buy a Sefer Torah. So right. Then the question is, can I sell Beit Knesset to buy Beit Knesset, or do I have to buy something higher?
Excellent question.
Which I'm sure the Gemara answers.
Excellent question. Which the Gemara does not answer, but is addressed in all of the Rishonim. Is it that you can only go up, or can you make a lateral sale? Right? The neighborhood is going... All these shuls...
Well, obviously for a Sefer Torah, it has to go horizontal.
A Sefer Torah presumably can only go horizontal, but what about everything underneath?
Well, if that goes horizontal, then everything else underneath goes horizontal as well.
Not necessarily. Maybe that goes horizontal because it's the only option. Right? But everything else has to go. So think about it. From our own experience, we know that synagogues get sold and moved all the time. Think about all the... I mean, what's the name of the shul in West Orange? A, B, J, and D. Avat Achim B'nei Jacob and David. There were three shuls in Newark. Avat Achim, B'nei Jacob, and B'nei David. They all sold. They merged the money together. They moved to the suburbs and built a nice synagogue in West Orange. Right? And all of these synagogues that, you know, were these conglomerates of smaller synagogues in the towns that fell apart, in the Bronx, in Newark, in Chicago, and right, the same thing, and they all, you know, it carries the name, and it has all of those yard site plaques, right? All the yard site plaques somehow, and in the Gush, if you go into the lobby in the Gush, they have all those old yard site plaques from that shul in
Geffen also.
The shul in Geffen also, yeah. We tried to get that once to get old yard site plaques. Remember when you were a kid, you'd come in on Kol Nidre night? They had those bulbs, which I'm sure are responsible for all the global warming. Right? You know, those bulbs that look like candles with a little flickering flame in it. And, you know, I remember the Shamus on Sunday mornings, would go. He'd had this like clipboard, and he'd go around and he'd turn on the bulbs for the people that were observing yard site that week. Yeah. But on Kol Nidre night, you'd come in and they were all lit, and it was like the Kivshana Esh. the lobby of the shul was like blistering hot from these. And then in the morning, somehow mysteriously, they were all turned off.
Oh, they all burned out.
The janitor came in and turned them off. But I remember looking at them and thinking, who knew there were Jews named Adolf? All these names that, you know, some of those names have come around. You see all these little kids, all these little Maxes and Goldies, but you don't see any, you don't meet any little Adolfs. V'chein b'motrehen. Okay, v'chein b'motrehen. Rashi says, in other words, aval machru Torah, if you did sell a Torah So you can't downgrade. Why? So the Gemara, so Rashi says, Shemalin Bekodesh Velo Morid. Shemalin Bekodesh Velo Morid. The idea of Ma'alin Velo Moridin implies
you can go horizontally.
That you can't go horizontally.
Specifically.
Right. Specifically.
It depends on which is the operative phrase in that.
Well,
is Ma'alin an imperative?
Or is it in
Moridin? Well, it means it's a bigger shul. Like you throw one shul one side, you try a bigger shul.
Well, we're going to come to that. Actually, the Gemara does entertain such possibilities.
You know, the motivation for doing something. You know, if it's just so the Kedusha is preserved, and then going horizontal would be okay. But if it's to discourage the quick sale of to discourage sailing these holy objects, and maybe it make you go up. The same way we have like, you know, kefil and things like that. We discourage, you know, or when you have all these fines, you have to use it for something else. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, there was a quick to sell something. In which case, you don't have to do all that, and then you wouldn't.
But if you look only at the language, it's very specific. It says you should go up, you should not go down. Well, it doesn't forbid.
But it does say no. But it says go up. You can go up.
It says you should go up. No, you have to go
Mali.
Up.
So it turns out that both sides of this coin are operative, and it has to do with a lechatchila and a bidyeved. Right? Lechatchila, you should be male. If possible. If you have a Sefer Torah, you're at the end of the dead end, you can't go up. But in all cases, afilu b'di'eved lo moridin, which means
you can go horizontal.
You can go horizontal b'di'eved, but you can't go down afilu b'di'eved. Afilu b'di'eved.
How do you go horizontal b'di'eved?
In other words, you should go up.
No, I understand, but what does it mean to do with bidyeved?
So bidyeved means if you did it, so then...
You did it by did it without knowing halacha.
You did it without knowing the halacha, or you did it in violation of the halacha, but it's still, the sale still counts.
Or you have no other choice.
Or if you have no other choice. Right? In other words, if you sell one thing and there's nothing to buy, there's nothing to be had higher on the menu, so then... You can't, even if you, so this is your point. What you have money left over, right? You have five, you're done, you sell the synagogue and you use all the money to buy things higher on the list. But when you're done, there's $5 left in the account, right? So what, you know, what do you,
it's like
a, right? So
kind of stucker.
What?
Kind of stucker.
No, I mean, I'm saying, if I take the money and I give it to stuck, I give it away. The leftover money, and I give it away. It's got to be less.
No, so that's
less
not that's
worse
not one, yeah.
than like saying I'm going to buy something that's lesser on the menu. Because I'm not buying anything.
Not necessarily.
Give it, you know, it's like same.
Right. You sell a Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther can go for a lot of money. Right. So you can use the money to buy a Sefer Torah. But let's say there's no Sefer Torah for sale. Well, let's say there's no. I don't know. I don't even know if it's like today. Today you can buy anything, anytime, anywhere you want. I don't know if that was always the case. The synagogues did not have the... We have, how many Sefer Torah do we have in the shul?
7, 8,
right? How many Sefer Torah did shuls used to have?
2, 3, 4
One? I don't mean when we were kids. I mean in antiquity. One.
No, when I was a kid.
Yeah.
In Muncie, we had 2 Sefer Torah, then we had a 3rd Sefer Torah.
Right.
And then we thought we got to Bar Mitzvah, we had like 5.
Right. But in antiquity, I'm not sure that shuls had 7 and 8, 10 kosher Sefer Torah. They had the Chumashim.
In elementary school, we used to roll the Sefer Torah every single every time we had
them. Okay, so let's just start the Gemara. B'nei ha'ir shemachru rechova shel ir. Omar Rabba Bar Chana, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, zo divrei Rabbi Menachem Bar Yossi stum ta'a. This anonymous opinion that Rechova Shel Ir has Kedusha, in other words, the Mishnah presents Rechova Shel Ir as one of the items, the lowest of the items in terms of levels of Kedusha, but the Mishnah does imply that the Rechova Shel Ir has Kedusha. Whose opinion is this anonymous opinion? That is the opinion of Rav Menachem Bar Yossi. Anonymous. opinion. Now, generally we say that when there's an anonymous opinion in the Mishnah, that's the halacha. Sometimes the Gemara will reject an anonymous opinion in the Mishnah, and often in order to do so, it will identify whose opinion that is. Aval chachamim omrin harachol
stumta means
stam.
Okay.
Right, anonymous, with no attribution. Aval chachamim omrin harachov ein bo mishum kedusha. The Rechav Ashliya does not have kedusha because it's not a Beit Knesset, right? It's not dedicated for the purpose of a synagogue. And in fact, look at the Rechav Ashliya. Yeah, it's true that we had that minion there on the Asar B'Tevet. But it's hard to say that the Park HaAsor is dedicated to Divrei Kedusha. Because if it was, you wouldn't be able to do skateboarding there. And you wouldn't be able to have, you know, whatever they have on Yom HaTzmut nights. Movie nights, whatever, anything else.
Yom HaTzmut, I don't know. I'm just kidding.
Rabbi Menachem Bar Yossi, Mai Ta'ama. Why does he say that it does have Kedusha? Ho'il va'amit palin bo b'taniyot v'ma'amadot. What are ma'amadot? We just talked about ma'amadot. Where did that come up? Ma'amadot? What are the ma'amadot?
The Kohanim go, the people from that town would have a...
Right. There were 24 classes of Kohanim. Who's a Kohen? You're a Kohen. Which, do you know which ma'amad you're in? You know?
No.
Anyway, it was like Miluim. You'd get Yitzav, you'd go to Beit Knesset, you'd go to Beit HaMikdash, and that was your... What?
Can you find out what section you're in now?
I don't know. I imagine that there are some people in the genealogical world that if you can hook yourself up to some figure who hooked himself up to some coin historically, but I don't know, I can't imagine. But, you know, like in genealogy, like there are certain jackpots. Like if you can connect yourself to somebody, that person had a tradition that they went back to HaMelech David, and you know it's like shoots and ladders. If you get to one point, sometimes you get to. So the Ma'amadot. So when the Kohanim from your town would go for their 2 weeks of Miluim in Beit HaMikdash, everybody in the town had a kind of chatzi holiday, and they had this tekes that they would do in the Rechava Shel Ir, where they would read from. No? Maaseh Bereshit. Right? And this tekes that you participated, the non Kohanim participated in back in your hometown while your Kohanim were in Beit HaMikdash, this was called the Ma'amadot. Rabbanan Hahu Akrai Balma. And the Rabbanan said, it's very nice, but it's just. Well,
infrequent.
No, it's not about my say. It's a cry. It's infrequent. It's not permanent. It's not. It does not render the fact that you sometimes use it for tefillah does not turn the Park HaAsor into a Beit Knesset into a holy place.
Interesting.
All right, we'll stop here.
Thank
you.
It's not right.